What's good, everyone? Gonzalo Orella here, Gomeluka Podcast, episode 3 of the Daily Debrief, which is not daily, so I've been lying to you guys. Sorry about that. But we're covering days 4 and 5. That's what we're doing. COP28.
Yeah. This is the Gomeluka Podcast.
You know, we are in the Article 6 negotiation team. The main focus coming into this COP was the 2 recommendations, amongst other things.
But for 6.4?
Yeah, 6.4.
Right, yeah.
But there hasn't been a lot of, you know, action around 6.4. There was a contact group meeting earlier on this COP, but for the last 2 or 3 days, it's been very quiet, I would say.
Quiet or like little movement?
Little movement, yeah.
Right, yeah. I think that's what it is. Like, it's not like they had nothing to say. It's like there's no movement forward because
it's not to say that they haven't been doing anything. They must be doing something. But
right.
We just don't know.
It's just there's no convergence.
Right.
At least not in the rate of convergence that you want to see at COP. You know, because you need to report to SUPSTA.
Yeah.
In two days.
In 2 days, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So basically, you have 5 days, because day one is a given. Like, nothing happens on day one.
Right. Just the plenary and
Agenda setting, yeah. Blah 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 blah. And then day two, they start to do all the agenda. So you have 5 days to go at your disposal.
Yeah.
It's 5 days at your disposal. Yeah.
it has to be kind of done maybe a few hours before, you know, the SUPSTA plenary, so the translators can translate the documents and do all the formalities.
Yeah, but there's no translation. It's all in English.
Yeah, but the L document has to be
translated. Oh, L document. Yeah, got it.
So really they have 5 days to come to a consensus on.
Right.
Before it goes to next week, which is a very, political setting where a lot of the things that didn't get decided this week will be sent to.
Right. So basically what you're expecting is that incrementally, you make progress. There's like a time schedule kind of thing. If you look at that.
Yeah.
So by day two, there needs to be this amount of progress so that you stick to the timeline so you can actually deliver to SUPSTA.
Yeah.
But what it looks like right now is that, like you said, it seems like very inactive because there's, people, states are hanging on to their views.
Yeah.
So it'll be interesting.
I think in the history of Article 6, it never really finished in the first week anyway. Right.
Oh no!
so it always.
There's always drama. Yeah. There's always drama. Yeah.
And then that's
what I'm. From an Asian people's point of view, that's always the one thing that is a challenge is the second week.
Yeah.
Right. So first week, if anything, if we have it, like there's much more access to experts and negotiators.
Absolutely.
To have bilateral meetings.
And we have access to the meeting rooms, you know?
Exactly.
And gauge the view of the parties and then form strategy.
Right. Second week is different.
Yeah.
Second week is, on a higher level.
Yeah.
Experts are in their own huddles, in their own cocoons doing the work.
Yeah.
And there's little to no, there's probably a contact group maybe, but there's no inf meeting,
right,
for example,
right,
or let alone an inf.
Yeah.
So right now, Santiago Network, they reserved a room from 3 till 10, inf on Santiago Network on the host.
Wow.
So just to give people an idea of it's crunch time, So when if you do not have any significant progress after day 4, going to day 5, then all right, alarm bells.
Yeah.
It's I wouldn't say panic, but it's like, all right, something needs to happen.
But
so
to what extent is there situation opportunity for indigenous peoples? I mean, yes, it's negotiations are deadlock and it's not what many people would want, but how would you exploit that, that chaos, like.
The chaos is like. Well, I wouldn't say call it exploiting, but making use of the opportunity is by keep saying in their face, like, so it's pressure cooking, you know? Like, yeah. So they already have pressure,
yeah,
but you add to the pressure a little bit, like, hey, yeah, guys, like just remember in Glasgow you decided this, yeah, X, Y, and Z,
yeah,
you decided to include the human rights approach, human, yeah, rights based approach, yeah, you know, like, so in that sense we remind them of it, and then, but it's also like, it's, you see like a triage, like there are contentious issues,
yeah,
moderate issues, and a less contentious, yeah, issues. Yeah. And what we've seen so far is that, like, the best thing for human rights is that when there are, like, super contentious issues,
yeah,
and human rights is like the less contentious issues, yeah, so there's an easier positive,
yeah,
outcome, negotiation outcome, when there are like big issues on the table. And also, so you make use of the opportunity of the state of play,
yeah,
to hopefully to drive a point home, or drive home what the idea is. But it's also like it's reading the room, mm-hmm, reading negotiation, reading the state of play, and knowing, all right, yeah. So when first we got to COP, we had this advocacy paper, like, mm-hmm, this, like, that's what we wanted.
Yeah.
And then you do a position paper based on a state of play.
Yeah.
But also, like, it's also part of, like, something that you also, like, take into account is, all right, what is, and I think we talked about it yesterday a little bit, is, like, what is the best acceptable outcome?
Yeah.
Right? So this is the best possible outcome. What is the best acceptable outcome, mm, in relation to your advocacy papers,
yeah,
so like you need to have some kind of a reference point,
yeah,
if that is a reference point, what is acceptable,
yeah,
to you, given the circumstances, given the negotiation,
yeah,
so it's, yeah, it's, that's how you try to read the game, how you play it, and, yeah, yeah, so, yeah, if exploiting it is a word, then that's a, yeah, word that can be used.
Well, then I guess we'll see where the negotiation will lead to. Hopefully there will be some updates in the next couple of days. Well, there should be an update in the next couple of days, because civil societies, as you know, are part of, you know, I mean, we're not negotiating, but we are part of this clout, and we kind of deserve to know where things are.
You know? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay, so that's the kind of speed that we have been kind of experiencing 6.4 negotiation, this carbon markets, and but there has been some development in 6.8. You wanna talk a little bit about, you know, what happened today?
Right. Well, so like it's an approach to 6.8 that we have started to take, and, you know, like in essence, like a lot of indigenous peoples, or like the general caucus, like is not in favor of the carbon market,
right?
The market approach,
right?
But if you look at the 6.8, which is a non-market approach, you see what it's why, for example, Bolivia was very adamant about, right, having that part of the Article 6 package. Mm. If you look at the texts, if you look at the objective, the purpose of the paragraphs in there, there's opportunity for indigenous peoples, mm, to showcase what a quote-unquote non-market approach,
yeah,
is, and which is because states have kind of not really, after 10 years, mm, an idea what a non-market approach is. Mm. So what's the difference between 10 years ago and today? Well, mm, today, indigenous peoples are at the table.
Right.
And also,
right,
that difference can make a huge shift, yeah, into the concept, mm, of non-market approach.
Yeah.
First of all, like, let's not call it a non-market approach,
because, right,
labeling is part of the game.
Right, right, right.
Right? So, like, let's call it sustainable development approach, or whatever.
But you call it lifestyle.
It is.
Yeah.
You know, like in the analogy that I usually, yeah, use, like, it's a change of lifestyle.
Yeah, yeah. Mitigation. through changing lifestyle.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
So if you think about that, you know, there's something that these people have been pushing for. Yeah. It's not like doing things as usual,
yeah.
Or business as usual,
yeah.
But actually you need a complete overhaul, change of lifestyle.
Yeah.
Now, 6.8 is a and I'm saying that it's the silver bullet, it's
right.
The golden opportunity,
yeah.
But it is an opportunity
yeah.
to showcase what indigenous peoples actually mean.
Yeah.
With we have the knowledge.
Yeah.
What we do to protect 80% of the world's remaining biodiversity.
Right.
You know, so it is an opportunity to put that on the table, but also, because that's what 6.8 is trying to move towards, mm-hmm. is to have approaches that other countries can emulate, can model from.
Yeah.
You know, and there's no incentive involved, there's no market
right,
involved,
right,
no in, right. No credits.
Yeah.
It just like goes to the intent of the cooperative approach.
Yeah.
Right? So starting to have that approach, and which includes bits and pieces of agriculture,
yeah.
bits and pieces of just transition, the
right.
way that indigenous peoples view it,
yeah. Yeah.
the human rights-based approach, like yeah. everything,
yeah.
it's like you can like package it, like slice and dice it, and put it into 6.8.
Yeah.
So, and I think the opportunity is there, we just need to provide that. Content
yeah.
to go into like so like
yeah.
we had so today was so 6.8 is it has a contact group, it has spin-offs
yeah.
and it has like the workshop
yeah
you know or the in-session workshop
yeah
spin-offs like we did see like a whole explanation of this platform fine I believe it
yeah.
fine like it's I we all know how Google works
yeah
we know all know how a website works
yeah.
all right but I get it but then you have the workshop where like presentations are made about like what a non-market approach is. Mm. Well, we've been seeing that for the last ever since Glasgow, seen these types of workshops. So, like, what I was trying to do at caucus for the last couple of days was like, hey, 6.8, what we need to do is to bring in people from agriculture.
Yeah,
bring in the knowledge holders.
Yeah. Yeah.
That are over here at the LSIP, like, it's almost like it's your favorite pet.
Yeah.
You know, you keep them caged or you keep them on their bench,
yeah.
you know, and then you drag them out to comp
yeah.
for their mandated events.
Yeah. yeah.
You know, and then you put them back in again.
Yeah.
Whereas I'm not saying that it's a problem. I'm just saying that you can do so much more with them.
Yeah. But then, sorry.
Yeah, no, but yeah. it's the... The purpose of the platform was to to create first of all was to get the knowledge holders to the decision making level
right
in addition it is to a co-creation of new knowledge
yeah.
by exposing
yeah.
the knowledge holders to oh no sorry the states to the knowledge yeah. holders so. What we did, today was about curriculum and everything
yeah.
else,
yeah.
about indigenous knowledge.
Yeah.
Whereas, like, an hour earlier, yeah. non-market approach.
Right.
And the only thing you have to do is talk about your knowledge.
Yeah.
Talk about what we mean with a non-market yeah. approach. And so, today, there was some presentations, World Bank, Jeff, all that.
Yeah.
Like, it's very, it touched a little bit about indigenous peoples, but yeah. it didn't, like,
get into it. Right.
Or... speak from an indigenous perspective.
Yeah.
What do we, because they yeah. say like, yeah, indigenous non-market, indigenous peoples have non-market approaches.
Yeah.
But what is it?
Yeah.
So, you know, like, so the signal is there, but not the content.
Mm.
So today was the great opportunity. And there was, and I very much appreciative of the co-chairs, you know, for giving that opportunity.
Yeah.
You know, to like, all right, so Andrea was able to do her famous slideshow, her PowerPoint,
yeah.
you know, about...
But I haven't seen that one, so
yeah, well,
I really enjoyed it.
I'm sure it will brought up at caucus tomorrow morning,
yeah, yeah,
and you get a PowerPoint
yeah.
in your emails the next, in
yeah.
a couple of hours.
Yeah.
But it was, the interesting part is that in that conversation, you do not have to shy away from mentioning colonization.
Right.
are mentioning human rights violations and everything else. So it's because it's part of like why this non-market approach is not, oh sorry, the indigenous lifestyle is not front and center. So it's part of the conversation. So it's that when Andrea was great. Bill Erasmus, you know, like brought it from the Alaska perspective, like the Arctic perspective. Even better. Then the youth came in.
Victor.
You know, like Victor Kerman from how he perceives it, how he wants to transfer the indigenous lifestyle, the non-market approach, and ask the part of the question, like, how are you going to contribute so that I can transfer my knowledge, my non-market approach to the next generations? And then there was this sister from Australia as well. And I think that is what we need to get to. Like it's rough, you know. It's a raw diamond right now. To put it in there. But you know, like and but we could make so much more of this of this opportunity, to of 6.8, to make it used as a hub. You know, like you have all these spokes. What is it? Food sovereignty, agriculture, just transition—all these things. But this could be a breaking hub.
It seems like you know you're very much optimistic about the potential it can have. If the no market approaches do end up incorporating a lot of the views that has been shared from Indigenous peoples in the room. So how does this no market approach? What is the potential of no market approach? Discussion on 6.8 compared to say LSIP, which is doing similar things, but 6.8 it seems like a bigger league.
The biggest difference, the way that I see it, people that go to LSIP go there for one particular purpose, is traditional knowledge, in these peoples. So, but with the non-market approach, or Article 6, actually, they go there with a whole different purpose. They go with, they want to operationalize Article 6. The audience is different. Because those are the people, those are the ones that you want to influence, because they, it is about them embodying the lifestyle that Indigenous peoples have, or the, at least the principles that Indigenous peoples have in how to combat climate change, how to respect the rights of Indigenous peoples in the struggle to fight climate change. So put it very bluntly, it's platform, we're talking to ourselves. Article 6, we're talking to CMA. Because everyone, like a CMA, like everyone has a stake in CMA. Right, so you see, I see that main difference is that between the platform and CMA Article 6.
No, what really struck me today was a statement made by Bolivia. Okay, so what is the difference between no market approach and a market approach and no market approach? And the Bolivian representative said, well, no market approach doesn't put price on nature, right? And doesn't trade, right? And my original thought was, well, the market approach, what market approach essentially does is to put price on, you know, everything from nature to even Indigenous people's knowledge and their land, right? Yeah. So the market approach is designed to deputize, right, Indigenous people's land and knowledge for the purpose of climate mitigation.
Right.
But then the non-market approach really is about, you know, is about different, having different relationship, fundamentally different relationship to nature and land. And I really hope that, you know, non-market approach also means a new approach to actually, you know, discussing climate change. And this is why I like Chief Erasmus' comment about, you know, nation-to-nation thing, because it's also like a non-market approach to an extent that, you know, in this approach, we should be talking about, you know, partnership and equality and valuing the lifestyle, or valuing the knowledge and resources. Without thinking about which one is better or which one has more or less value.
Yeah.
And I found that to be a very, very kind of positive and constructive discussion.
Yeah, it brings a whole new dimension to the conversation, right?
Right.
The indigenous dimension, if you will. But Victor said it also like very well, is that respect, reciprocity, consent.
Right.
And these are all principles that about like how we have a relationship with, not with each other, but with the natural environment.
Right, right.
And each other. Mm. And so this brings a whole new dimension to the conversation that has been lacking.
Yeah.
And we all thought that, or not thought, but like we were looking for a separate stream that could do this, where Indigenous peoples could like, all right, showcase. We thought that the platform would be it.
Yeah.
But it turned out to be like, yeah, it has the elements to interact with bodies inside and outside of the convention. Mm. But you do see that its default mode is inwards, not outwards.
Yeah.
I think, and this is not because just because I'm in Article 6, but I think that this is a good opportunity to bring life to 6.8, bring life to our, and put our knowledge and our lifestyle, our identity, our culture, and everything else into the views of and the state of states.
Yeah, and just maybe you could tell me a little bit about what Andrea and the chief and Victor felt after that meeting. Did you speak to them afterwards and how they kind of felt the atmosphere of the workshop?
Oh, 100%. Well, first of all, like you had two Indigenous youth representatives that have never spoken in a UNCCC context before.
Right.
You know, they're like, so what should I say? So,
yeah.
My default answer is like, well, speak from the balls. You know, just talk. You know, don't worry about it. Yeah. You know, it's a workshop.
Yeah.
No pre-prepared statements.
But into the report, right? So.
it never goes in the report verbatim.
Right.
You know,
right,
like there's always like some kind of a reflection or a summary of it. But like, so that's what it always starts. Like, don't overthink things. You know? Yeah. Just share. You know, like let the overthinking be done by people like myself and negotiators.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
But like you are there to like be a voice of Indigenous peoples. Mm-hmm. So speak from the balls.
Yeah.
Anyway. But like I think it's this sense of empowerment.
Yeah.
It's like, whoa, hey. It's a sense of empowerment mainly because you can talk about what you want to talk about without putting it into a straitjacket.
Right.
Yeah. It's what you always wanted to talk about.
Yeah.
You know, and it's not even, because that's what all the states are afraid of, is that like, oh, Indigenous peoples are going to talk about like 500 years of colonization.
Yeah.
It's part of the issue, 100%, colonization.
Yeah.
However, you do see that the mindset at the table when we did those presentations was totally different.
Mm.
It was like, hey, we're here to contribute.
Right. Right.
We're not to complain, we're here to contribute. Mm. And I think that is empowering to not just to us, but it's also a signal to the parties.
Yeah.
You know, and it's...
Do you think there is a broad kind of view by the party still that Indigenous people are here to complain? Do you think that's what people not like, you know?
Always.
Yeah.
Okay. Always.
Yeah.
UN stays a club of states, and there's always this view of parties like, all right, you guys, just shut up for once, you know, like let us do our thing, stop complaining.
Yeah.
But this is actually like a whole shift, you know, like we're going to contribute.
Yeah.
The only thing is the vocabulary is not what you're used to.
Right. Yeah.
Like. It's not numbers, percentages, and everything else.
Yeah.
It's actually lifestyle.
Yeah.
It's
human,
like, well,
human thing.
Right. So let me talk about the buffalo.
Yeah.
let me talk about like reindeer husbandry.
I heard of permafrost.
Permafrost, like all those things that of that they're not used to or hearing in a conversation like that, or in the in the CCC.
Because discussion is a whole lot different than market mechanism, right? Like when we do 6.4.
Well, I had two like youth reps that wanted to shadow me, and they're like, well, first of all, I had to like give them the whole like rundown of Article 6 in like in a way that wouldn't make me want to kill myself.
Right.
But so I gave them the rundown, and then they're like, all right, I think we get it. But especially when it comes to 6.2.
Yeah.
I said, well, hold on, like you're gonna sit there. You're gonna want to take notes, but you're not able to make sense of it.
Right.
So just sit there, listen.
Yeah.
Because it's gonna be super technical. Yeah. Like, are you sure? I say, yeah.
Yeah.
You know, like, doesn't matter if you're a PhD student or whatever. Like, it's gonna be super technical.
No, I mean, even when we were in Madrid, you know, I was trying to kind of follow 6.2 because it suddenly became a very important agenda for indigenous peoples, and I was making notes, but you know. None of them make sense, like option 2, option 5, like...
Yeah.
Like, it just doesn't. And then you try to report back, but there's no context, there's nobody knows anything about it, and then you know,
Well, imagine yourself back then and now.
Yeah.
And, like, I think I'm fairly certain that for everyone, the level of confidence of knowing what 6.2 entails, it's like this much more.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
So and then to realize that in Glasgow, we were talking about corresponding adjustments, double counting,
additionalities,
all these terms, these words actually like a word soup. Like I don't know what the hell that means.
Yeah.
Fast forward to now, like most of it has kind of been resolved.
Yeah, kind of.
And still like, well, we're still waiting for the final verdict on registry and everything else, emission avoidance, just to name a few.
Yeah,
but still, like, we're like,
But I think it speaks to, you know, but we are really good at understanding specific part of the negotiation that concerns indigenous peoples.
Yeah. Okay. Right. We don't need to know everything.
Right.
Like we're not negotiators at that.
Yeah.
To have to do that, but like, the specific parts that affect the rights of Indigenous peoples, mention Indigenous peoples, that.
But do you think Indigenous people will eventually have to go beyond that, right? Like not only talking 100%. About the rights, but talking about let's talk about corresponding adjustment because it, you know, in the end, everything affects Indigenous peoples.
Right. Yeah. But it's. That's what I mean. Like it's the bandwidth of Indigenous peoples. I'm not saying that we're stupid, but it's so super technical,
and building capacity is so time consuming and so.
It's a full time job.
Yeah,
like, it's 100% a full time job.
Like for you to train someone in a caucus to get to where you are right now in terms of competence and skills and.
No, to be honest, I don't even know where I am right now.
Yeah,
but
It took me, you know, for 4 years, really, 4 to 5 years, to just come to understanding about, you know, things about grievance mechanism or there are some parts of the removal.
So out of interest, obviously out of interest, how did you learn or teach yourself, quote unquote, teach yourself Article 6?
I definitely didn't learn much from the negotiation text itself. To be honest,
nobody does.
and then you go into like you go into dark holes of Wikipedia and Carbon Brief and try to understand, but you just don't understand the concept, right? I just don't understand additionality. I just don't understand corresponding adjustment.
Just words. It's just words.
They're just words and something that you just drop to make it sound like you're intelligent, you know. I learned most of the negotiation by actually, building positions. I think that's one thing.
Okay.
Because in order to build a position, you have to know what you're talking about.
100%.
Right?
Yeah.
And then in order to understand Indigenous people's position, like, okay, we have a position on removal, we have a position on grievance mechanism. Then I really rely on experiences of indigenous peoples, right? The context that they're able to provide from the elders and from the people who's been in the work for a long time.
Right.
They will be able to tell us, okay, this is what grievance mechanism, or this is what grievance is, right?
Yeah.
What we mean by grievance. This is what redress mechanism. This is how it relates to a specific article in the UN Declaration of the Rights of Indigenous Peoples.
Right.
So I learned the declaration. I mean, I don't know all the articles off by heart, but I learned the basic principle of what indigenous people are trying to defend and promote. And through that, and I look at the documents through these lens, and I'm pretty sure a lot of people do as well, right?
Right.
And through that learning, you know, I really managed to make a connection between, okay, what part of Article 6.4 to 8 concerns human rights, and rights of indigenous peoples.
Right.
How will this particular paragraph affect not just indigenous people but myself as well? You know,
because
I'm affected.
You're human.
I'm affected by this mechanism as much as not probably as much as indigenous peoples, but you know, we're all in this together, in a way.
Yeah.
And in a way, I also felt that indigenous people are also protecting my rights because they are promoting human rights and the rights of indigenous peoples.
We do.
Yeah. So
well, we
so
try to.
So so. Yes, I've been to side events. Side events sometimes clarify some of the things I don't understand.
Right.
Because you can ask questions. But you know, most of the things that I've learned come from just being engaged in the practice of building positions, listening to the people who've been in this process for a long time, who can provide context. But that's it, you know. But that's all I have. There are so many other sources of information that you can rely on to learn about this process.
Yeah.
But when you're in a game and you have something to stand for, then that's where you put your chess piece and says, this is where I'm standing.
Yeah.
Feed me. You know?
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
Teach me something.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. It's fascinating how people like learn things.
Yeah.
In their own way and all that. I have a slightly different approach though.
I just want to add, like, you have to put yourself in with the right people. Because there are people.
How do you know when you put yourself with the right people?
Well, I mean, for me, it was like, well, Ghazal, you're the chief negotiator of Article.
I could be an idiot. I could be an idiot.
Yeah, and you could be an idiot, and you could have exterior interests.
Yeah.
I could
want to be like. A benefiter of the common markets.
Yeah, but I look at other people within the Indigenous Peoples Caucus, you know, and who shows up and what they do, I navigated myself was to, okay, people who just doesn't seem to show up the caucus every day or we look for consistency, right? I look for consistency.
Right.
And people who are committed to stay for 2 weeks, right? That's like, okay, those people are like in it for something.
Yeah.
Maybe they have a bit of funding, but but for in it for the whole day, the whole thing, right?
Right.
And then you look for, okay, so people who I see at the negotiation, right? Because in the end, the whole point is to exercise the right to participate in the decision-making process, or exercise the right to ensure that indigenous people's rights are in this text.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Right. So okay. People who are actually exercising their right to be part of this colonial institution is the people I was looking for.
Okay.
And speaking of side events is also very important because you are exercising your right to speak for yourself and speak for people that you represent.
Yeah.
But I was looking for a diplomatic action, and that is, you know, because that is where people will say, indigenous people, we the indigenous people, want this from this process.
Yeah.
You were at the time, negotiating the LCEP on behalf of the caucus.
Yeah.
So you were representing a whole world of indigenous people. And then you know, once you finished that, you moved on to Article 6, yeah. And then you moved on to, you, and then you, and then you, and then,
And then lost in damage.
And then lost in damage. And I see you, you know, I see you in Indigenous People's Office just typing in email, you know, in Katowice, right? And then sending emails to all these delegations while other people, where are the other people, right? At the platform, there were 20 or 30 other Indigenous peoples in the room. And they have been consistent.
Right.
But then where did they go after the LSIP?
Right.
And this is when I
celebrate,
felt,
probably.
Yeah. Christmas market.
Yeah, yeah, oh, that too. Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But this is when I really felt that, okay, this guy, you know, he's really into this, right?
into the game, because I didn't know anything about.
But you continued to represent the caucus, yeah. Right? Because everybody thought the LSIP was what they came for. Well, at least that's what I felt, you know. And then everybody kind of started going back to the regions or started doing their own thing. And then in Madrid, it was kind of similar.
Like, right.
Okay, the platform is now established. So what do all these people who are focusing on platform will now focus on? They kind of like,
right,
went different direction.
Yeah.
And what happened to the agriculture? And what happened to the adaptation and other, you know, important agenda items? Why do we have, why do we have a consistency in Article 6 but not in any other work stream?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I don't. How should I put it? I can only speak for myself.
Yeah.
Right.
And I can only speak for myself, yeah. that the way you I think I made a right bet in a sense that you have remained consistent for the last 4 years in terms, mm-hmm, of advocating for a particular position. On behalf of the caucus to the states.
Yeah, but it's also something that you can't like suddenly like drop out.
Right.
Like, so you're right. In the middle of negotiations, like, yeah. This is not my cup of tea.
Yeah.
You're like, so in the sense that I'm like, the way that I understand,
yeah,
diplomacy,
yeah,
and negotiations is like, well, yeah, you're in it, or you choose, you choose a process that, I don't know, that interests you or whatever. Look, carbon markets didn't interest me at all.
Well, but it interests your people, right? That's the,
exactly. Yeah, you know, it affects, yeah, your people.
Yeah, exactly.
You know?
Yeah.
So you dip yourself in there, and then consistency is basically just turning up every time.
And I think that's the most important part of, like, you know, just having the mandate, right? Like, you represent the people, and people expect you to deliver. And
well, people expect you to represent them,
yeah,
right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Delivering is basically like based on what you promised them.
Yeah.
You know, in these people's good, for example, the cost could expect, yeah, me to, like, I don't know, kill carbon markets.
Right.
All right. Yeah, but that's not really a viable,
yeah,
solution, or,
yeah,
that's not even realistic. Yeah. You know, yeah, like, but so. If the objective is attainable and based on your expertise or your knowledge, yeah, you're like, all right, yeah, it's in a way, yeah, it's doable. However, you need to have some amount of bandwidth.
Yeah.
Also, like, what is the most ideal case and what is acceptable to you?
Yeah.
But yeah, it all starts and ends with, like, yeah, with the mandate
and I expect people with the mandate to have a very consistent, you know, kind of practice. I mean, you know,
it helps.
Yeah, it helps. I mean,
yeah.
And you have a specific priorities that the parliament or the traditional council wants you to work on.
Yeah.
And then you navigate the COP and SUBSTA and other places according to that, you know, priority. So,
mm-hmm,
so, you know, and then you go home and you have to explain to people what you did and what you have, you know, what you were able to accomplish or not accomplish.
Right. So imagine that, like, just to my people or but Indigenous people in general, like, all right, because tell me what Article 6 says,
yeah,
in Madrid. Well, first of all, we fucked up in Madrid.
Yeah.
And, like, we were, like, so off key. We're not even on the same song, yeah, in Madrid.
You know, I still have this piece of paper that, do you remember this?
The position paper?
Position paper that was like a scribble on a scrapbook.
Right.
And Kenneth was like, Kenneth asked me in the negotiation, like, what's the sentence that you want to put into this text, because I'm sitting next to Mexico and I need it.
Yeah.
And so I scribbled it down and then gave it to Kenneth, and then Kenneth gave it to the Mexican ambassador. And I still have the paper because I thought at the time, maybe this paper could change something. But then, how naive was I?
Well, we all were super naive. Yeah. We all thought we had it all figured out.
I thought that paper was going to be historical.
Well, in a way it is. Yeah. In a way it is. Yeah. But I guess, so yeah, it's...
Or historic, sorry, yeah. That would be the word.
But the thing is that Madrid going to Glasgow.
Yeah.
So yeah, so then people like, sort of like, oh, Ghazali, what is Article 6? Yeah. So the moment that you're like the lead and just explain it, but you don't understand it yourself, like, you're in trouble.
Right.
And all like, so like your process of learning things,
yeah.
or you go through your own process of learning yeah. things. So I figured out what my process is to just bring it to like a human level, as in like being able to, so I the way that I force myself to learn Article 6, learn carbon markets, is like, all right, how would I explain it to a six-year-old?
Yeah. yeah.
How would I explain it to my sisters and my little brother that have nothing to do with UN carbon markets? Mm. How would I explain it to them? So, and then, like, it's not like what I figured was, it people, when people learn something, is not, they don't want to learn like what it is. Mm. They want to know like what it is like.
Yeah. Okay.
So like, so I started using analogies, yeah, right? Yeah. You know, like metaphors and, but mostly analogies, you know, like, yeah. and then, all right, so now I understand it myself. Mm. So it makes me much more confident when you explain to others, you know? And then, because if you have to explain to someone else and you have no freaking idea what you're talking about, right. it shows.
Yeah, yeah.
It absolutely shows. Because if you get one question,
yeah.
that is like as simple or is it as lowest hanging fruit as
yeah.
ever,
yeah.
and you like stumble through like syllables and words and everything else, yeah. then like, all right, yeah. You need to do a better job in terms of learning what your, because people have expectations, you know? Like, so they expect you to like to know, at least be able to answer some of these questions. So.
Yeah.
So yeah, so that was, Madrid was fun.
Yeah.
But yeah, now like it became some kind of a game from able to understand it to being able to explain it to a six-year-old to explain it to a six-year-old in 6 minutes.
Yeah.
You know, so that's how, that's the game that I have in my head.
Yeah.
Is it 100% healthy? I don't know, but it works. It works.
Yeah. So and I think, you know, a lot of people from Indigenous caucus do come to COP for the first time. And they also need to kind of quickly catch up, like, you know, 2 days or less than 2 days.
Yeah.
To a level where they can say, okay, I have a stake in this process. Like this is where I need to be at.
Which makes you're putting yourself into a very difficult position. If you're new to COP, to not only understand COP, but also like understanding it in a way that you can commit to a process, to a stream, or because. I assume eventually you have to report back, or at least you have to write a report to your funder or whoever.
Yeah.
Like, and I don't think, because I haven't seen a funder yet, that finds sufficient to say, well, yeah, I went to caucus in the morning, and went to a side event, and food was great. Mm. Hopefully, you'll fund me next year. Mm. You know, like, you actually need to be able to, like, all right, so what did you do, and like, what, how you impact, and all that stuff. Mm. So it's for people that are going to caucus, you're putting yourself into like a very difficult position. If you're new to UNFCCC, if you're new to climate change, that you go to COP. Mm. I would go to stuff first. I would go to Bonn first.
Right, right. Yeah.
Like,
and I'm glad that I did. I went to Bonn first.
Right. Yeah. Can you imagine if you would have gone to COP first?
Man.
Go to Katowice?
It was a Katowice, yeah.
Yeah.
I don't think I would have had the, you know, similar level of network that I have today. because everybody in Katowice is very busy, right? And yeah, it's just a lot more intense space, and there's not a lot of space for friendly courtesy coffee and courtesy anything. But
it's,
you know,
game
Bonn,
on. Yeah, it's game on. In coffee.
I mean, Bonn was already kind of game on because you had a lot of
influence. Yeah.
But still, you know, I think it was nice to have had a lot of indigenous people in that room, because mm-hmm. then I was able to kind of, you know, stick around until 11 p.m. and talk to anyone. But if you go to the negotiation now, you only probably see like two or three IPs at the back. And
yeah.
And I'll be like, okay, maybe I go to the LSIP, you know, like that's...
see more there. Yeah, it could be.
But I mean, if you're watching this and thinking about coming to the COP, I mean, come whenever the next meeting is, but be aware of, advantages and disadvantages of coming to COP as your first, and
nothing beats thing. Personal experience, right?
Right.
Nothing be like we could like record like 1,000 hours of videos.
Right.
And that would still be trumped by you stepping into a sub-stem, Bonn for like one day.
Yeah.
You know? So like nothing beats personal experience. So that's why I'm like,
it's always a splash. It has to be a splash somewhere. Like
you just go dive
right in, and then
I can like, well, I jumped into COP21,
which is a big one.
Oh my God! Yeah.
It's a big meal for her first timer.
Well, COP21 in the second week.
Yeah.
I was only there for only one week, but if like,
but crazy. If you had to choose between week one and week two.
Oh, week two, 100%.
You would go to week two.
Because I like the challenge.
Okay.
That's my problem. I like the challenge. So, yeah. I like the odds. Yeah. You know, like.
I mean, maybe I would have come to week two because then you would have nothing much to do because you'd be out of the negotiation room and sitting around.
Yeah, so but Paris was different.
Yeah.
Paris was different. You know, like, so like people were trying to figure things out and like there were still like meetings and all that stuff. So Paris was different. But like nowadays, like if.
Yeah.
Yeah. But it is something to be thinking of if you're like an indigenous person is thinking of like, well, yeah, get your feet wet. Get your feet wet in Bonn.
Yeah.
And don't think, this. And that's what I have to say as well, don't think like you've been to the Perm Forum for 10 years and like, if I can handle Perm Forum, then I can handle, or if you can handle MRIP for 10 years.
Yeah.
Then you can handle COP. Like it's not a comparison.
No.
It's I don't know what is the right comparison? Like what's the right analogy to?
But you know, I went to COP first and then went to the MRIP. Remember?
Right. Yeah. But you do see the contrast. Right?
Oh yeah, yeah. I mean, MRIP is a place where people will listen to you. You can speak your mind and people will listen to you and you don't feel rejected in a way.
Yeah.
But here, like, you can be turned away by the UN security and, you know, it's a lot more, I felt a lot more kind of, not fear, but how do I put it, like...
Anxious?
Yeah, like anxious, like, because you know, parties are very, it's party-driven process, right?
Right.
So MRIP, Unit Permanent Forum, is like it's kind of like an indigenous-driven process to an extent that they set the agenda and they chair the meeting and do all this.
Yeah.
But here it's like, you know, there's a clear line between party and observers. And if you try to cross that line, right?
Yeah.
There's a certain intensity, like intense feeling, like.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that's something that I feel here even today.
Yeah, it's like a. The first thing that comes up in my mind is ant farm,
right?
You know, like or maybe like a box full of, you know, crabs.
So that's your analogy.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's what I think. Like I think in analogies, or a bunch of hawks.
Mm.
That's what COP is. There's a lot of hawks in there, but like it's, and then I don't know.
I kind of
is like dolphins.
I kind of feel it like airport custom, and we have to go through the red zone. Why the party can go to the green zone?
You know what I mean?
And we always have this nerve, like a kind of feeling of nervousness even though you've done nothing wrong, like when you go through these like customs, you feel like you go through the security, you see people watching you like, oh.
TSA looking at your passport, looking at you, looking at your passport, looking
at
you.
Exactly, like, they look at your badge and like,
yeah, true.
You know, if you have the wrong color, it's like, you know. And they have gone, like UN police has gone, and it kind of intimidates me a little bit.
Unless you know them, because they're brought in from Vienna, New York, Geneva.
Well, they're human. They're human.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, everyone is human.
Yeah. But, you know, you don't tend to associate, these days, you don't tend to associate law enforcement with in a humane way.
No, but then again, like, it's UN police, you know, UN security. Like, it's, I ran into, like, the other day when we walked
Geneva
in.
Guy, right?
The Geneva guy. So, this guy was, like, so surprised that I recognized him.
Yeah.
Like, I walk into Geneva office, like, it's, I don't know, it's like my office. Like, hey, I recognize you from Geneva. And, like, I just felt that he was like, testing me?
Yeah.
So where's your office? Like, well, you know, like, down there. And like, well, so you can speak French, right? And like, I do speak French.
Maybe he's practicing to be a detective.
Something like that. Yeah. And then he came back, like, to, I don't know what it was, but look at my badge again. Like, what? I was like, all right, I already went through security.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah. But I mean, that's just the kind of personal experiences. And
right.
And I think, but these are not universal experiences, but...
No.
But, you know, it's a feeling of being an observer at the COP.
Right.
All right. So we kind of detoured a bit, but it's kind of interesting conversation. And I guess the recap part, is there anything else? Do we need to recap? Do we miss... anything? I mean, there was like a side event for subsidiary bodies yesterday, but
supervisory body, by the way.
I was getting it wrong with the SB.
It's SBI, SFSA,
supervisory body. But yeah, it's I don't think there's much I would probably discuss there.
My friends, I hope you enjoyed this. Please consider to subscribe, to comment, and to share this video on your socials.